He is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He is a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum for Bagrum on Law and Life, 101.9 High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for joining us this evening. I really appreciate it. Every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m., it's Michael Bagrum. It's a regular show. And we always try and introduce interesting people. We interview people. We look at their background, their history, their CV, what work they're doing. It's very interesting stuff. I've had some wonderful feedback from our listeners. So please keep feeding me with names, with interesting topics that you want to hear. Just about anything, I'm happy to hunt down people and actually have discussions with them. And like per normal, we have a wonderful guest with us this evening, Gerald Spector. And I'll go through a little bit about his CV and then ask him to take us through some of his past life. And then we'll come up to where we are today and what business he's involved in. And get a little bit of background to the interesting work that he does. He has sent me a very cryptic CV. He was born in 1957 in Durban, believe it or not. Like a lot of us, his paternal grandparents, in fact, both my sets of grandparents came from Lithuania, Estonia, and of Russian origin. Spells an interesting story for the whole of the South African Jewish community. And his mother, from his maternal side, they were French, from France. He, in fact, spent his first year in France. Obviously, he then went back to Durban. I see that he moved. I'm not sure why he'll fill us in, but when he was between the ages of 4 and 6, the family moved to Paris, and eventually they came to Cape Town in 1964. He went to Friedrich Primary School. That's where my wife ran a feeding scheme for 10 years. And then his mother converted in 1966, an interesting fact over there. And he then had to have a mikveh after that conversion. His bar mitzvah was at the Great Synagogue in 1970. I was bar mitzvahed there in 1969, so I'm 1 year ahead of you, Gerald. And Cape Town High, and that's where we met at Cape Town High School in 1970. To 1974. We both matriculated in 74. It was a bit of a miracle that I passed, but I did eventually matriculate in 74.
You surprised us all, Bags.
Yeah, I certainly did. In fact, most of my teachers were quite surprised. You went on to UCT, and that's where I lost contact with you completely. You did a BSc in chemistry from 1975 to 1977. I went off to Rhodes University. We had no contact. There was no internet in those days, and there certainly wasn't Facebook, and we lost touch. I know that in 78 you moved to France back again to carry on with your studies, and you'll tell us a little bit about your military service there. I think I complete my sugar now, but there you are. You went and did military service in France when everyone else was running away from South Africa. And then he did a doctorate in chemistry in Paris, 1980 to 1984. I'd be interested to know why you did that doctorate, but I suppose it's interesting. And, of course, it was beneficial for you because that's where you met your future wife in Paris in 1982. So at least you got some benefit out of the doctorate. And you and your wife settled in Pretoria in 1986, and you got married in 88. You have two children who I know, both Claire and Ivor. I know your children. I've subsequently met them, and when we reconnected again, I know that you worked in Johannesburg for Protea Chemicals and SA Druggist, 86 to 99, and you became the general manager of Orthochem in the Free State in 1996. And then, from what I understand, is that you had a management buyout in 99. You're one of the owners now of that company, and you produce things called, let me get this right, mold inhibiting preservative. It sounds really weird, and you'll tell us a bit about that. But when you bought the company in 99, you built it up, and from what I understand is you're still involved there, and you're still a director and a shareholder. And but you are living now in Franschhoek from since 2022, and you make a comment at the bottom of your CV. You've been unsuccessfully trying to retire ever since. I think I'm in the same boat. But Gerald, just in terms of our personal connection, obviously we were at UCT, not UCT, at Cape Town High School together for those 5 years. And we both joined the Mountain Club, and that's where we had a common interest. We certainly didn't have any interest in chemistry together. Although I was eventually, after graduating with from matric, I was sent to Rhodes University to go and do pharmacy, believe it or not. I think I lasted, I think it was 2 days, well, almost 2 days doing pharmacy, and went crying to my student advisor to say, I can't bear the smell of this pharmacy department. So we're very different on that level. But let me hand over to you. Tell us a little. I've gone through the pen sketch. Tell us, flesh it out a little bit from basically when you from when you came to Cape Town in 64, went to Frederick Primary School. You obviously lived in the City Bowl area. Over to you.
We were in France for a couple of years where I started school. That was because my mother obviously was homesick, and we tried to make a go of it with my father not being really French speaking and not having a work permit. So it was we battled along for 2 years, and then my parents eventually gave up. But rather than go back to Durban, my mother wanted to come back to Cape, well, go to Cape Town, because for her that was the only part of the country that that was a bit like Europe for her, and the weather was a bit better for her, not as hot as Durban. So we had quite a bit of family. We had on my father's side, we had quite a most of the cousins, etc., were based in and around Cape Town.
All
So
spectres.
that's
They're all.
no, they were. We were the only spectres, actually, because that was on my grandfather's side. The family in Cape Town was all on my grandmother's side. She was one of 12 children, so there obviously were quite a lot of relatives, although only about half of those kids came to South Africa. The rest stayed in the Baltic states and Eastern Europe. But still, it was quite a widespread family. And on arrival in Cape Town, we stayed with sort of the cousins that we were closest to, the Tictons. And my cousin Machel Tickton was the treasurer of the Great Synagogue. And since we were staying with him, it was sort of four of us, my parents and my brother and myself, in his house in Aranjuezicht. I think he felt a bit crowded out at some stage. And the shul had an old abandoned house just across the road from it, which he generously suggested we could go and live in, and for a really very very small rent, which helped a lot. So that's when we moved into gardens just opposite the shul, and that's where we stayed for the first few years, until
And that
1971
was
and then.
during. Okay, then you went to Cape Town High, which was up the road
So
from
yeah,
there.
I wasn't very happy with my parents' sort of logistical planning. When we were in gardens, for the whole of my primary school, I went to Frederick Primary, which is halfway up the City Bowl, going towards where, not too far from where you lived. And then in 1970, I went to high school. That's where we met. And that was wonderful because I just had to cross the road. It was literally 1.5 minutes to and from school. But then, unfortunately, in 1971, my parents decided to move right to the top of the City Bowl. So I was stuck for the rest of high school with the
Walking
reverse
down.
coming from the top down every day. So that wasn't great. But anyway, the great thing was that I really enjoyed my time at Cape Town High School. We had a great bunch of people, teachers and fellow students, and you obviously were were prominent amongst them, the clown of the
Now,
class.
I can tell you what's interesting, and I've recalled it with a few of our old friends from Capeton High School that I think it was almost a quarter of the school was Jewish. A weird sort of strange thing, but it attracted a lot of Jewish students to Cape Town High School. I'm not
Well, I
sure why,
remember,
but
yeah.
that's it was a, it was a, someone was telling me it was over 25% of the school was Jewish, which was quite a weird concept. The other thing is, of course, today Cape Town High School is still going strong and still there, but it is. So I went and visited recently, and it's 100% black. I don't know why no white students have enrolled in the school, but it's still there. It's still looking absolutely pristine and good. Okay, the hall's in a bad shape, but it evoked lots of good memories. And in fact, I think you joined us on our 50th anniversary at the
Yeah.
school, which was an interesting exercise. We even got one or two of our teachers to join us as well. But yes, yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
No problem. Yes, so well, as you were saying, in our standard six class where we met, I think more than half the class was Jewish. It was quite compared to the other classes, which led to the sort of rather strange situation that, normally in a school, if it's a Jewish holiday, the other kids stay at school, come to school and work, and the Jewish kids get off, and the other kids get jealous because now they're not at school and they're having fun. With us, it was the other way around because on a Jewish holiday, especially the high holidays, we ended up having to go to shul, which I always found a bit of a drag. But because so many of us were not in class, the rest of the class couldn't actually do any work because there were just too few of them left. So they used to have fun at school because then the teachers just sort of messed around with them.
And you had
And
to go to the
it
garden
didn't
shul.
work out the way, it didn't work out the way we would have hoped it would work out. But anyway,
Well,
that's
it's I'm still a member of that garden shul, and I'm still very happy there. But yes, I do remember getting packed off every Shabbos morning down to walk to the shul and back, and it was literally a stone's throw away from our school. Okay, so
Yes.
at school, you then joined the Mountain Club. I presume you joined any other societies or clubs.
I wasn't
I know
very
that.
active. I wasn't very active at school. I was ex extremely shy, so I didn't sort of put myself forward for many things. I did a few outings with the Mountain Club. My main contribution was playing in the rugby C team, in which you played as well,
And neither of us were any good.
and going out to the Afrikaans schools in the northern suburbs and getting totally massacred every Saturday morning. But it was good fun because there was never any disappointment because we never had any expectations that we would win. So it was just a question of laughing at the scale of the defeat. Yeah, school I thoroughly enjoyed. I think as you can vouch, we had a good group of teachers and a good group of students in our years, and I found it really a very rewarding experience. I never regretted or got bored or
I do remember one mountain trip where you tried to bite a rock, and
that.
lost a tooth, if I remember correctly. I think you hopped from one rock to the next and missed. I don't know
No,
if you recall
I remember that very well because that was a miscalculation of
that.
the momentum of of a body that moves from one spot to the next. I jumped from one rock to another rock with a full pack, not realizing that the weight of the pack when I landed on the other rock was going to just push me forward until I came head first onto the bottom of the rock and knocked out part of a tooth. But yeah, it was the beginning of a very good trip. It was on the first day, but the rest of the trip was great.
Yeah, it was good, and the rock was intact, so most of us were
Yeah, there was
happy.
no claim from the property
So yeah, and we went on many of those trips. We had a teacher by the name of Dave Jordan, who often used to help us on those trips, and the chapel, Norman Mearns. We had great teachers who literally every second weekend there was some activity happening as you went away with the school. I don't think they do, schools do that much nowadays. There's too much competition to try and get good marks, but they didn't seem to think that was important for Cape Town High School. What was more important was we enjoyed our schooling. But
I
yeah, we
think
were very active on in those
you
years.
would. You would know from the point legal point of view. I think schools these days would be terrified of the indemnity issues with taking a bunch of kids and telling them to hop, hop on rocks and cross rivers and things like that.
Well, look, the bottom line is some schools obviously still do it, but it's not as probably risky as what we have. And I remember one trip, we had to come down a mountain in the pitch dark. I think they set us off. They miscalculated how we could get back in time to the combis, and we had to leave at about 4 in the morning in the pitch black, coming down quite a treacherous. I don't know if you remember that trip. I can't remember where it was, but all I remember is one of the girls in the class, Jessica Abrams, shouting, "Where the hell are we?" In the pitch pitch black. And one of the teachers, I can't remember who, said, "Well, look, everyone hold on to the ropes that we're, and then you must check to see, who's in front of you and who's behind you, and report if anyone's missing." That's how risky those trips were. But yeah, let's move on. You went to UCT to study chemistry. What got you involved in that?
I developed, for some strange reason, an interest in chemistry in Standard 6. Maybe due to the teacher. By the time you get to matric, most of the time you don't really know what you want to do with yourself. So I just thought, well, I have an interest in it. Let's try it out. And once you've started and you've done, put time and effort into it, then, you've got to actually just carry on with it, hopefully not sort of change your mind at that stage. You at least did it right in the beginning, so it
Yeah,
was
I know.
most
I'm
your
not so sh I know,
thing.
no, not really. I'll fill you in on that. But I immediately, when I went off, I was supposed to register for pharmacy and lasted literally 2 days and decided it was no good. And then registered for political science, so not law at that point. But chemistry, I think I was in your chemistry class at one stage. I think it was in standard six, standard seven. Grade, what were they called then? What's called
Grade
grades?
eight,
Eight and
grade nine, yeah, who cares?
anyway, the bottom line is I was in your chemistry class and I remember heating up a teaspoon on the Bunsen burner in the chemistry class, and then there was a fellow standing in front of me in short pants, and I used my teaspoon to burn the back of his knee. You might recall that incident, but I had a teacher standing behind me who had broken his arm and had it in a plaster cast. But I didn't know he was behind me. When I burnt the fellow in front of me, which was supposed to be a joke, it turned out to be very sore. But I didn't know my teaspoon was red hot at that point. I then got smacked on the back of the head with the plaster cast. That fellow never really forgave me, but I still kept in touch with him. His name was Leslie Robinson, who got burned on
Oh,
the back
was
of his knee. It was
well.
him, but he does mention it every now and again that the back of his knee is still sore, sort of 55 years later. But
Well, I'd watch out. I'd watch out because, as you know, we're going off into the mountains this weekend,
yeah,
and
correct.
he's one of the people coming with us. So
Oh, well, okay.
don't remind him.
No, I'll try not to, as long as you carefully don't do either. Okay, so you're at UCT from 75 to 77. You did the BSc majoring in chemistry. And the reason why I wanted to follow up on all of this is because it led you to your career. But before you did any of that, you then in 1978 moved back to France. Reason?
Well, the reason was that at the end of the BSc degree, I was, in line for military service. And in South Africa at the time, mid-70s, it was a 2-year service with the war on the border. And France still had conscription, so there it was a 1-year service, but there was no war, unless the Russians tried something. But it looked
Wow.
like
So, did you
looked like
join
much
the
a safer option.
Legionnaires? You could have been recruited into the Legionnaires. You could have had really problem
No,
come back to
that's
Africa.
they actually don't take French people. It's only foreigners. That's why they call them the Foreign Legion. So I wouldn't have qualified. But as it turned out, I spent most of my time in an office filling in forms. But it was still an interesting experience.
And
And
your
then,
French was fluent at that point.
yes, because. When I was young, we'd lived in France, and my mother always spoke French at home. So we always were sort of fluent in French. And then, obviously, late 70s, South Africa wasn't looking like a very hot option. So, the idea was that I would stay in France and just finish my studies there. So that's. After the army, I went and registered for a doctorate, which I did in Paris. And unfortunately, when I finished that, it was mid-80s, 84. France was going through a bit of a depression, and there were just no job opportunities. Whereas in South Africa, things were picking up. Having met my wife Margaret at that stage, and she worked at the South African embassy there, she was due to be sent back to South Africa. I wasn't finding work, so we decided the best thing would be for me to join her in South Africa and find work here. So I came
And
back
she worked, you said
in
she'd worked
86.
in the working for the diplomats in the
She worked
embassy.
in the military section at the South African Embassy in Paris.
Okay, and I
So
know she was
she,
doing
she
some translation work as well.
yeah, she was the official translator. So she was translating all the secret documents because at that stage the French and the South African government had quite close military cooperation. They supplied, weaponry and things.
And also our nuclear information
As well.
came from France, Okay.
So
And
anyway,
you
that's
then did your doctorate, you finished the doctorate and you came back to South Africa. That's
and
correct.
Margaret being from Pretoria, that's where I based myself, and obviously that's where most of the work was, Joburg, Joburg area. So we settled into Pretoria. I found work in Johannesburg, and from that basically was the start of my career in chemistry.
And it says in your CV you went to work for Protea Chemicals and SA Druggists. What did you do there?
Well, yeah. Look, Protea Chemicals was bought out by SA Druggists, so it was a continuation of the same company, different name. I worked mostly on projects. My direct boss was Dr. Willie Besson, who would be familiar to anybody who was involved in sports in those days. He was head of Northern Transvaal cricket and very involved with sport at government level as well, as a consultant. And he was in charge of projects. So he basically used to allocate me to different companies in the group to work on specific projects, which kept me busy, although none of them really led to much, so I can't claim anything there. But eventually, in the late 90s, the SA Druggist Group got bought out by Investec, who realized that the sum of the parts were worth more than the actual group itself. So they unbundled the group, sold off the interesting assets, and at that stage, I'd been transferred to this company in the Free State that, was battling, not doing very well at all. And Investec had one look at it and decided that was a dog's breakfast. So They wanted to get rid of it or just shut it down, basically, which created the opportunity for the management, myself, and three partners to make an offer for the business to take it off their hands and go on our own. And that's what we did in 99. Knowing from being inside the business that there was a good chance it could be saved, but it was not guaranteed. So it was a tricky operation in the first few years, but eventually it got onto its feet. And for most of the time after that, it worked quite well. No
So what
complaints
did
there.
you what, how did that work? Did you buy 25% each or all become directors
Yeah.
or how did okay,
We
so
were
the
all.
buyout then had equal partners of the four of you.
Yes.
And what were
I
you
was the.
what was actually producing? Were you still producing or you, this mold inhibiting preservative that what you were making there?
That was always the main product, still is. There were a couple of smaller products that one of that sort of have disappeared with time, but the basis for the business, and as it is still now, is a product called calcium propionate, which if you look at what's written at the back of the packaging on any loaf of bread, you'll see it's usually right at the end of the long list of ingredients because they don't want to scare people off by a funny name. And they assume most people won't read right till the end, but that is really what we make. And that essentially is a product that goes into industrially produced bread throughout the world, and retards the development of mold in the bread loaves. So it's an essential product in all industrial bread baking. And we were the only producers in South Africa, and apart from a couple of really small outfits in South America, we were the only large-scale producer in the Southern Hemisphere. So that gave us a good position to, corner the market in South Africa, which we
Now
did with time.
I'm going to cut you over there and we're going to have an ad break and then we'll come back
Okay.
on. You can jump right off the platform.
Okay, will do.
He is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He's a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum at 6 p.m. for Bagrum on Law and Life, 101.9 High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us again. It's always good to pay the bills and have an ad break. You're with Michael Bagrain. It's every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Please remember that it's an interesting program. We have interesting guests. We are always waiting for input from you, the listener. Please come back to me and tell me who you'd like to hear from. I'll hunt them down. Always good programs, and we have an in-depth look at an individual and their history, their CV, what they're doing, and what's interesting. So we're with a wonderful guest this evening, as Gerald Spector. He's been through his CV with us. He's shown us his life journey from his paternal grandparents from Lithuania and Estonia, mother's side from France. Their family moved to Paris. They came back to Cape Town. He was at Bar Mitzvah at the Great Synagogue, Garden Shul, as we all know it colloquially, where I was as well. He came to Cape Town High School. There I met him, and we've had an interesting background. I lost touch with him when he went off to UCT to do a BSc in chemistry in 1975. That's when I lost touch with him, and we hooked up again many, many years later, about 40 years later, when we went got in touch through the internet again. And in fact, what we're going to be doing this coming weekend, we're going to be spending some time as we've had a group of friends from the Cape Town High Mountain Club. We are getting together again this weekend. It's now 52 years later. We've done a few trips since school, since we hooked up again, and he's just now taking us into what he does. He's used his doctorate in chemistry into buying into a company producing mold inhibiting preservatives. I love that. I'll keep repeating that. And it's called OrthoChem. They're still there in the Free State. They're still manufacturing that. And we were just talking a little bit about after the management buyout of OrthoChem, which he still is a part owner. And he eventually moved to Franschhoek, but I know he spends time there in the Free State at the company. And I think he's there now while we're interviewing him tonight. So, Gerald, over to you.
Okay, well, just to carry on then from where we left off,
Yeah.
the you know if people are interested in the technical details of the product, just briefly, over the years, if one thinks back on when we were growing up and a bit later after that, you used to buy bread in a shop. It used to be just a naked loaf on the shelf with a piece of paper around it. And that was the way it was usually distributed through the retail outlets. And then sometime in the 80s, the industrial bakeries moved to plastic wrap bread and sliced. So they were going for convenience, sliced and wrapped in plastic for hygienic reasons to make, you know, to avoid that too many people touched the bread before it was bought. And also by wrapping it in plastic, they kept all the moisture in the loaf, so the loaf stayed soft and for longer, which was a great plus in terms of, you know, the average customer. Unfortunately, the side effect of that is that what they created was an absolutely wonderful luxury hotel for mold, because they had a food source, they had all the moisture that they wanted, so. Whereas the bread before used to dry out on the surface and mold didn't develop, once it was plastic wrapped, you started having problems with mold development quite soon after baking. And therefore, you needed to extend the shelf life by a few days so that there was enough time for it to be baked, sold, eaten before the mold started showing up. And that's where our product comes into play. It basically extends the shelf life by 4 or 5 days, which isn't a lot, but it's sufficient to get the bread sold and eaten before any mold develops. And you know, it's a critical ingredient, because without it, then half the bread would be sent back to the bakeries as returns. So, as I said, we were the only producers in South Africa, and everything else had to be imported from North America or Europe. At that time, when we bought over the company, the market was dominated by a Dutch company. But with time, we managed to win back most of the local market from them and build up the business. So, well, that took a good 10 years or so, but at least then we were secure and doing quite well. At the same time, having most of the local market, we also developed an export market in primarily Southeast Asia, although we also exported to Europe and America as well at odd times, and into East Africa as well, and into Israel. We had an Israeli customer for a few years. But our main market has always been Southeast Asia, and at the moment, that's the only part of the export market that remains. That extended our business and caused us a bit of a problem in that we were running short of capacity. We had a pretty old production plant that you
Now,
couldn't
tell me
really
how this
upgrade.
is actually done. Is it, how do you actually make this inhibiting preservative?
It's chemically, it's dead simple. It's just a reaction of an acid, which is propionic acid, the main raw material, with lime, which is calcium oxide. And that makes then the salt, which is calcium propionate. So chemically, there's just nothing to it. The problem, though, is that you need to do it in quite large-scale equipment, which requires quite a bit of capital. So it's not a product that you can make in small quantities, you know,
at home or
Just
something like that.
at a small scale. You've got to do it on a reasonably large scale for it to be viable. And the other peculiarity of this product, which is why not many companies make it, is that the main raw material, which is propionic acid, is only made by very few companies in the world on a large scale as well. So you have very few possible raw material suppliers, and you need to have a supply contract with one of them to ensure that you have reliable supply. So that keeps a lot of people out of the business, because the raw material producers, will favor a particular customer and give them beneficial conditions in their supply contract. So we have mostly been importing from Germany. We still do, and so that really is why the business here, sitting in the middle of the Free State, for various historical reasons, but not very logical ones, has been going for so long. Things
Yes, let
have
me go
stopped.
back. Can I go backwards a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Does it go into every single bread, or are there some breads that are manufactured without this chemical, this preservative?
It all depends on the shelf life required. So anything that's got this plastic wrapped will have it automatically. Some of the supermarkets bake on site. Since they normally bake and sell the same day, they don't really need to put it in because it doesn't require much of a shelf life. But most of them, just as a precaution, still use it. The bread that doesn't need it, obviously, is the sort of Mediterranean European type of bread, which is baked and eaten, the same day or the next day, and which usually has quite a hard crust. And obviously, a dry crust will not allow the mold to develop very
Well, so
easily at
it
all.
begs the question. I went to France a few years back now, and bought a baguette. We were in a self-catering on a barge, a self-catering barge. And I thought if I buy four or five baguettes, it'll keep us going for 2 or 3 days. But the next day, you could have actually sharpened the baguette and killed someone with it.
Yeah, it
So
could have
I
been an
don't.
acid guy. Well,
So I don't. I mean, I presume they didn't put anything like that in there because it certainly was very far from soft, and that was 12 hours later.
yeah, no, that's why in France, for lunch you buy your bread in the morning, and for supper you buy it in the afternoon. That kind of bread goes hard very fast, so you certainly can't keep it, and it's not plastic wrapped, it's all just open. So it's not a that part of Europe is not a market for us. We rely on the sort of British type of bread, which is just the loaves,
The
sliced loaves.
government sliced white bread.
Yeah,
It's the
so
Albany
that's
bakery type of bread.
Yeah, exactly. That's where it's used mostly. With the business growing over the years,
Oh,
we've
just before you
essentially.
go into that, I'm thinking of challah, when our wives bake challah at home. I presume they don't put anything
No,
like that in
no.
the challah. The challah, although it's still fresh the next day, you can eat it to your mealtime on Shabbos, it does get quite hard after a day.
Yeah, well, any bread will dry out quite quickly if you don't wrap it up. But for home baking, nobody's going to put a preservative because you bake it and you eat it very quickly.
Especially me,
So
yeah.
it's not a product that's sold retail in any kind of supermarket or anything. It's only used by the bakers themselves in their formulations. But anyway, as I was saying, as our market grew and our local market grew and the exports grew, we ran short of capacity in our factory down in Bethlehem. And just under 10 years ago, we had a stroke of luck in that in Bethlehem itself, there was a clover dairy production facility where they used to do powdered milk and coffee creamer. And they were busy restructuring and getting rid of non-performing assets. And as a result of all of that, that plant got mothballed. And we managed then to buy it off them. And because we did some trials and it was suitable for our product to produce on the equipment they had. So that solved a big problem. And we've been running then that plant as well ever since. Although at the moment now the coffee creamer business that we have there has taken over from the bread preservative. So we run it mostly on coffee creamer.
And where do you sell that coffee creamer? Do you sell it to the supermarkets or?
That's all done under contract to the food company. So it's Clover is our biggest customer. We basically it was their factory. They're basically buying a lot of product from us. They should have kept the factory for themselves, looking back. But you know what? When accountants at head office get involved, things get decided that aren't very logical. So we produce for Ladysmith Dairy, Clover Dairy, and a few other small customers. And most of that gets used for a lot of it goes into the prison service because they don't have refrigeration for the prisoners there for their tea and coffee. And a lot of it gets formulated into other food products as you know an alternative form of fat. So that's quite a quite a good business. Unfortunately, while that was growing, we had faced a problem which most people in most parts of the world have been facing or are facing now, and that is the Chinese coming into the market. And
Big
that has had a
problem.
huge impact. That has had a huge impact on us, like everybody else. So the coffee creamer business hasn't been affected, but they are very cheap imports of the bread preservative coming into the country, and we've been losing market share now for a good few years. And you know, it's putting the viability of that part of the business at risk. It's got to the point where our volumes have dropped at to a dangerous level. So that is a concern for the future. I'm not too sure how
And
we'll
that
get
was the
around that.
mainstay of the business, wasn't it?
It was.
Not the
It
coffee
was.
cream.
That's where most of the margin came from. The coffee creamer was just an extra. Now it's the other way around. The coffee creamer is carrying the bread preservative. So we'll just have to see how we manage that. So I might find that it will force me to retire if the business goes down. But for the moment, we're still trying to keep things together.
So you're doing quite a lot of commuting between Franschhoek and the Free State.
Yeah, every 6 weeks, 2 months at the most, I come up for a week. So that it's actually nicer than when I lived in Pretoria. In Pretoria, I used to commute every week down to the Free State for at least 3 or 4 days, and that was for over 20 years. So that was a pain. I work from home, and it's you know it's much easier. And then coming up. Every couple of months is no great punishment. So there we go.
And Franschhoek is going to be your retirement town. You're going to actually settle fully in home you've bought there in Franschhoek.
Yeah, we spend most of the year in Franschhoek. We're about 2/3 of the year in Franschhoek and 1/3 of the year in France. So we basically leave Franschhoek for the winter and come back in the spring. And I just
And
work from home.
you've come back to a large fire in Franschhoek. Is it out yet? Is it? I've been reading a lot about the massive fire that you've had in Franschhoek.
It eventually, last week it basically died out, but we had a good 2 weeks of non-stop fires. As one was put out, another one would start up. So it was quite a bad situation. I'm sure everybody in Cape Town could see all the smoke
We
and
felt the smoke. Yeah, we could smell it. Yeah, correct.
So while the north was having their floods, we were having our fires. But
Yeah.
I suppose that can be put down to global warming, maybe. But who knows?
Well, not put down to bread and a chemical inhibiting
We deny
chemical.
all responsibility.
Well, we're reaching the end of our program, and I do want to thank you. But just before you go, you and I have had lots of discussions about sort of world politics and the rearrangement and the strange world we're living in terms of political leaders and the rearrangement of life, especially since October 7. And I know it's been working heavily on your mind and the problems that Israel's been going through. And we've had long discussions about that. Are you feeling more positive now about the future for Israel and world politics?
Well, it's a two, it works both ways. On the one hand, yes, I'm quite a bit more optimistic in the sense that Iran is seriously cut down to size, or has been. The proxies have been, not destroyed, but reduced as well substantially. So overall, the security system situation in Israel is better. Obviously, the Palestinian problem is going to take a long time to solve, but I think in terms of immediate danger of a major war against Israel, I think that has now receded. It will be interesting to see what happens with Iran now and with Trump the way he's talking. But one way or the other, Iran is not where it was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
What the flip side of the coin, obviously, is the totally irrational and quite unbelievable rise in anti-Israel, anti-Jewish sentiment throughout the West. I mean, you don't expect anything different in the Middle East, but just looking at comments on Facebook posts or internet posts coming from, countries that you don't expect it to come from, people with names that don't sort of look like they should be thinking that way. It's frightening. You
Yeah.
just wonder, was it hiding somewhere all the time and coming out now? Is it something new that's been sort of
Yeah.
brought out
That's
by all the propaganda?
another discussion you and I will have in the future. But Gerald Spector, thank you ever so much for giving of your time and your energy
Well,
and sharing your life with us. I really appreciate it. Hi FM applauds you for doing that. So I really appreciate it. And I look forward to many more hikes with you in the future. So thank you.
so do I. Thank you for inviting me, and good night to all the listeners.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Hi.